Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday. It's been a while because we did not have the weekly update last week, so there's plenty to talk about. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to... Mr. Honlein, sorry about that. Welcome back to JM in the AM.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be with you.
And we always say we should start with good news, and I think we should end with good news as well. But in this case, I could certainly take care of the former. I take this opportunity to wish you and the entire Honlein and Bach families a very special Mazel Tov. Last night was Shmuel Bach's Bar Mitzvah celebration, and we say Mazel Tov, Malcolm.
Thank you, and it continues the Shabbos.
All right.
And he's a terrific young man, and... spoke beautifully, and he's, thank God, so it's a great nachas.
We've had discussions, Malcolm, both on and off the air, about communication with future generations and just how important grandchildren are in that role. And let's just put it this way. You have, thank God, some amazing grandchildren who take current events very seriously, follow the tradition of their grandfather, right?
They certainly do, and they listen to the show, and they listen, read, and I hope that all young Jews and parents, grandparents, will make sure that theirs follow in the same way. It's not something you can impose, but you can help develop the interest by talking to them and by stimulating and getting them to understand why this is important. It's not as important as the Super Bowl, but it is important.
And if Grandpa makes a misstep on the air, they'll let you know, right?
Oh, immediately.
Of course. All right, we heard of the passing of Ed Koch this morning. I could only imagine how many encounters you had with him over the years. Certainly safe to say somebody who took his pride and tradition very seriously.
I knew Ed for many, many years. When I came to head the Soviet Jury Conference in New York, Ed was shortly thereafter a member of Congress,
right,
and was really very supportive. He was always outspoken, but we really started a relationship from the very beginning when I came to New York, and it sustained through the years. When I was at JC, the head of the JCRC in New York, obviously I had much more dealings with the city. But we also have there's a group that meets regularly, and Ed Koch was one of the people. And he always, until just a month or two ago, when we had the last session, always has a lot to say. He was deeply devoted to Israel, and even if when you disagree, and there were plenty of times to disagree with him, you knew that basically where his heart was.
Yeah, no question. He'll be remembered fondly, and I think Jews around the world, not just New Yorkers, took great pride in him.
You know, one of the things that I remember is when he was mayor, he was so ubiquitous, and because some of the super stations, you know, the New York stations, obviously covered him a lot, that
right,
people in the Midwest were asked, what's the name of your mayor? And they would say, Ed Koch.
Talk about nationwide influence. Well, he certainly proved it, and he is remembered fondly. If you look on Facebook, what's going on, people have amazing stories and really a lot of good feelings toward him. All right, Malcolm, it's been a couple of weeks since we last spoke. There's been an election in Israel. Many people, you'd have to assume at this point, especially in this audience, are familiar with the jockeying that's going on in order to form this government. Was it no question that Shimon Peres, the president of Israel, would ask Prime Minister Netanyahu to form the next government?
Yes, because there's no alternative. Yes, because the 81 members of the Knesset of the 120 recommended that he ask the Prime Minister, again, because there was no alternative, and there was nobody actually seeking to present an alternative. There were some vague attempts early on in the election to create a coalition that fell apart. Lapid talks about himself as the next Prime Minister,
right,
but for now, there was a consensus that it had to be Netanyahu. The question is what kind of coalition he could put together.
Right. One of the things we spoke about, and Mayor Weingarten was here a couple of days after the election emphasizing this point, is that we've seen in Israeli politics flash in the pan parties all of a sudden do very well. You know, he talks about being the next prime minister. It's possible his party won't be around. But it's
not. Well, Kadima went from being the biggest party to having two seats and just narrowly having that.
Right.
Getting in. And we know from Dash, from Rat, from all these other parties over the years, it is true that parties shoot up, and then look, Labor came back to a reasonable showing, but from the beginning said they, Achimovich said they will not be part of a coalition, and was very adamant about it. We'll see if that changes, but I think it's pretty certain that it won't. We have to see whether Lapid will come into the government and if he'll be able to sustain his basic points, which have to do with the middle class, has to also do with sharing responsibility. And there are all sorts of efforts now to find common language. I know that Bugi Yalom proposed some language, the Minister for Strategic Affairs and Deputy Prime Minister, that Shas was agreeable to, but then Lapid yesterday said that he wants his language, nothing else on this. So there are very contentious issues, and the first matter that Prime Minister will have to deal with is the budget, in addition to a situation on the north heating up, in addition to Jordan, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there's a lot happening. We've seen the influence of, quote-unquote, hope and change, and the desire of an electorate to just, make a vast change and bring in a new person, but this seemed so remarkable, almost double the number of voters than what the pollsters expected in terms of Lapid's party. So what do you think happened? Was it, a sweep all of a sudden just days before the election? Was it part of the media campaign or commercials that all of a sudden turned so many people to his party? Or was this happening all along? We just didn't realize it, that this avalanche of support was coming his way.
My feeling is it was a dynamic that was underway. I don't think that the commercials, or I've not seen anybody who assesses the commercials as making a vast difference. I saw that in the week before the election, more than half of the Israelis I speak to, most of whom are obviously politically involved, did not know how they were going to vote. This was a protest vote. This was a vote against the establishment, as I think Bennett's strong showing was also, to a large degree, a vote. Nobody saw the Palestinian issue that Tzipi Livni pushed, for instance, as valid today. There is a national consensus on the foreign policy issues generally within a range, the issue of Iran, et cetera, et cetera. So it focused then on domestic affairs, part of it about shared responsibility, i.e. the draft for all people, Haredim, the participation in the economic process, et cetera. So Yair Lapid, very cleverly, defined his positions in terms of support for the middle class. You cannot really look and see a full platform that you could say, well, these are the principles and everything that he stands for. We will hear more, and I think he particularly kept it vague so that people didn't feel they were violating any standing commitments by voting for him. On the other hand, they were sending a message that they want something different.
So can we say it this way, then, to sum up what I think you'd agree with, that there were a lot of protest votes out there, and essentially anybody who wanted to protest had Bennett or Lapid to go to?
I think that's right.
That's basically it. What about the religious parties? Where do they stand after the election now?
Well, Shas has a good chance of being in the government. I'm not sure yet that a deal with Lapid will actually work out, which means that you could have a very strong opposition, and if Bibi moves just to his right and there's a 61-59 split, I don't know that he wants to bring Bennett in at this point.
Wow.
We will have to see. I think there were reports, various reports and explanations about why he did not want them, or at least to have a coalition before and then bring him in, where you limit their ability to make demands. When you have a narrow coalition, everybody can impose on you the conditions and demands from the government. So I do think that it was protests on both sides.
A month ago, we would never have believed that Bennett would not be part of Netanyahu's coalition, or that's not necessarily true?
I think everybody had assumed, and I think still think most people would assume, that eventually they will be able to work it out.
Right, and he'll be part of it. Very interesting. And the whole one thing we have to say, if we were looking for a pollster in Israel to really boost their reputation after this election, it never happened.
I've told you many times on the air and off what I was told once, and that is, Israelis are the only people in the world who tell the truth to pollsters and then lie at the polls.
That's the way it is.
So that's why you can't blame the pollsters. They get it right.
And, it's funny.
Pollsters got it wrong.
I always thought it was the opposite, that they're lying to the pollsters, and then what they really want, the truth, is what they offer at the polls.
Well, that may be the reality. I was just telling you a joke.
No, I understand. But now I have to apologize to somebody who told me that was the joke you've been telling, and I, of course, was arguing with them. So I apologize. Unbelievable. All right. As you say, lots going on, including what's happening up north. So Israel goes ahead, and supposedly, I don't think they've publicly acknowledged this, they've taken out a convoy of weapons that was going from Syria to Lebanon. Now, it's 5 years since the attack that we know of, that, again, we presume that Israel had on the nuclear reactor site in, or the supposed reactor site in Syria. I would think these convoys are heading in that direction constantly. Why now did Israel decide to take a, you know, to undergo an airstrike?
Well, because it's the quality of the weapons. First, we do not know whether it was a convoy or a facility that was hit. Israel has not acknowledged, and there are various reports which are unconfirmed about whether it was, in fact, this institute near Damascus, which is reported dealing with chemical weapons. Was it a convoy of missiles going into to Hezbollah? And for a long time, Hezbollah has sought to get more and more advanced weapons, such as radar systems, and Iran has supported it because for reasons that I'll tell you in 1 second. But they also purchased these Russian surface-to-air missile systems, and with North Korea, they developed the Scud-D missile that can carry a missile, 1,000 kilos of explosives, and even possibly chemical weapons into any part of Israel. And Syria has between 300 and 500 of these Scud-D missiles. So the Hezbollah has, for a long time, sought this these SA-17 anti-aircraft missile launchers because they have a long range and very sophisticated tracking, which means that it would limit Israel's ability either to hit Syria via Lebanon or even flying over northern Israel, were they to get it. And there are reports that, that these were being shipped or other kind of long-range missiles.
It's amazing. Just like certain, you know, assassinations are targeted because certain people are more important than others, so too convoys get the, you know, have to be judged what's important.
Well, don't forget, before you largely had missiles, and Israel did take out some of those, but the by and large, these were being shipped over land, by sea, by other means. The buildup, you know, is very serious in Hezbollah land, where you have the 50,000 plus missiles. And Iran, despite the economic conditions, everything else, continues to supply weapons. We saw it just this week in Yemen, where the Yemeni forces intercepted a ship with a large, huge stockpile of surface-to-air missiles and other high-grade weapons, explosives, rocket-propelled grenades, and other things as well. So Iran wants it because, and there are three possible prospects. One is that they are trying to get Hezbollah to build up its capacity in order for it to attack, maybe a low-grade attack against Israel, you know, shoot at some planes nearby, coming near the border or over to the border in Lebanon, some provocative act, because that would detract attention from Syria, perhaps creating a situation in Syria along the Syrian border, and that's why you have the buildup in the north of Israeli tanks. That would enable perhaps the forces, the army and the rebel forces would unite, or they would, in order to face the common enemy, that would force them to come together, or a diversion against the pressure now on Iran. There are many options as to what the thinking is behind this. I mean, why would they take the risk? Why would they do it now? The other thing is that this could be Hezbollah weapons that they're withdrawing. We know that they, for instance, sold Hezbollah agents chemical weapons. It could be that Hezbollah was removing weapons of their own because they see the way the war is going, that they could have been consolidating, and everybody admits that they have taken heavy losses in Syria and that their position is somewhat weakened in Lebanon.
The Israeli gas mask distribution is now at a very high level?
It's certainly accelerated, and people in Jerusalem and other places being given it because of the you have the chemical and biological weapons. That is the great fear that Israel has and has been working very carefully. And that's why I think it's equally likely that the strike was against some sort of a facility where chemical agents may have been mixed or developed. I think the fact that Hezbollah has built camps near major facilities, chemical weapons facilities, is a matter of great concern. And the ability to transfer these in trucks, where you have a mobile laboratory essentially to mix them, and the delivery systems, which is why the missiles were important, and you saw that Iran launched a transatlantic missile,
right,
capacity of transatlantic, with a monkey in it. Well, that means that they have improved, and their science program and their missile programs are just, space programs and missile programs are integrally related. This is all one. But it means that you can send a warhead over the Atlantic or over regional targets, and instead of monkey, you could carry a weapon, right, or even a chemical weapon.
And to that, you say that that threshold that we've been concerned with is now officially passed in terms of a distance capability, or not yet?
Well, it certainly shows that the NEI report is all wrong about the weaponization, the delivery system, and the enrichment. On all three areas, Iran is moving ahead all the time. The West is now offering them, 5%, 4% enrichment instead of if they stop to 20%. All of this is wrong. There should be no enrichment. That's why you have to have absolute red lines, because to go from 4% back up to 25 and 20 and 20 to 90, these are easy. Once you have 4%, it's only a matter of time. I've told you many times, and just minor technical achievements. So Iran supposedly is stepping up its enrichment. We know that they have improved the weaponization, and now you see the delivery systems are being advanced all the time.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, 91.9 FM now in Rockland County, online around the world at jmnam.org. My thanks to our friends at JewishWorldview.com, who continue to recommend to their readers to tune in not just to the weekly update, but to jmnam.org 24 hours a day. Big thank you and Shabbat Shalom to our friends at JewishWorldview.com. You didn't happen to see the PBS documentary on Ilan Ramon last night, did you?
No.
I thought it was great, thought it could have been better. It was very good, thought it could have even been better. But my point is, it's unbelievable the Jewish pride and Israeli pride that someone like him felt on his shoulders as he went into space, how much bigger his role as a national hero, as his status as a national hero developed, and how he took it so seriously. And you know what it reminded me of, Malcolm? And I hope you're getting these same anecdotal reports that I am. Are you following how many American young men who are heading to yeshivas in Israel after high school are going directly from there to the Israeli army?
There are many, and many who go to learn in Israel in order to be to facilitate that process. It is quite remarkable, and we have hosted.
I mean, my generation was closer to the Six-Day War, and you'd think, as we get more, away from those types of events, things like this would wane. And it's just the next generation is booming with Jewish pride.
And Chayalim Bodedim, the lone soldiers who often whose families are here, that they go all by themselves.
Right.
And I met two who are from kibbutz and now working there. And he said, I want to work the land. That I want to contribute. I don't want to, and they don't want to have history pass them by. They feel that previous generations missed the opportunity, that when Israel was given to us, that we are not there. And these are not misfits, outcasts. These are the most wonderful, wholesome, sincere, religious kids that you could meet. I mean, just remarkably intelligent.
It's unbelievable.
And just one word. I met with Ramon before he went up. He came to visit me, and he gave me this beautiful autograph thing, which hangs in my office. And what you see, what you've said, was who he was all along. And people who knew him well, and friends who were very close to him. And in fact, he said to me that after the mission, he was going to come back because he wanted to do some additional things with children here, with young people in America. He was a truly remarkable man. And what you've said is just the tip of the iceberg, and I hope it'll be properly recorded.
And that whole story last night of the Torah from Bergen-Belsen that he took in space is unbelievable. I mean, the whole thing is unbelievable. And on the other issue, I just want to tell you that I was informed by one of the non-Hesder yeshivas in Israel that 12 of their boys from last year are now in the Israeli army. I went to a Hesder yeshiva. I don't think there were 12 Americans that went at that time to the
you
army.
You have to qualify also.
Thank you. Well, don't worry. Nobody thought I would go. I'm talking about the group as a whole. Now, how does Iran feel the responsibility to offer retaliatory talk about an attack on Syria? Why would Iran go ahead and make a public statement against Israel?
Well, they first of all said that any attack on Syria, they weren't talking just about Israel, because, you know, the United States and others have threatened to do more in aerial surveillance attacks, etc. So they said that this is an attack on Syria is an attack on Iran. They think that they have these immense vested interests, that this is part of their national security position and posture, and certainly interest. So they made this declaration. They've made similar declarations before. This was, I think, the most blatant. But don't forget, this also ties to their whole regional position of sustaining their relationship with Lebanon, which they're very concerned about. Right. If Syria falls, what this will all mean. So they are now trying to protect their vast investment in Syria. But at the same time, Iran continues to reach out everywhere, and we should not minimize that. It is being aggressive. You saw the Argentinian-Iranian discussions, which we can talk about, because they're very important, what they're talking about doing. But you see how in Latin America they continue to reach out. In Africa, we hear more and more reports of their involvement in the Gulf, everywhere. And it is not diminished, despite the sanctions. And by the way, their oil exports are now at a four-month, five-month high, and especially because they're selling so much to China, which was given a waiver after first diminishing their imports, but now have exceeded what they were in the past.
Well, we're talking about, you mean Iran?
From Iran. Right. From Iran to China.
Right. By the way, I'm sorry for bouncing around, but on the Israeli elections, will it take till the end of February to form a government? Is it going to? Because they're talking about, you know, whether he'll meet the deadline of his visit with Obama, which is likely in March, but will it take that long?
Well, first of all, I don't know that he's going to come in March. It's a possibility at that conference, but I'm not at all certain that that will take place. Second, because that has to be prepared, they have to make sure that everything is the right timing. Second, it could well take him a couple more weeks. A lot of people thought that he could move quickly. Remember, he started the day after the election,
right,
making the phone calls. Usually they wait until the president makes his calls and meets everybody and gives the mandate to whoever is recommended by most parties or most members of Knesset. So Bibi, assuming that would be him, he started right away, and still we see that we're not that much closer. He had vague understandings. I think some of them have already fallen apart. You know, it's a jockeying negotiations. It's very it's over a lot of issues in a lot of detail, and then you have to see compatibility between the different parties. It's not just negotiating with him, but then it becomes between the different parties. So it well could take another couple of weeks. It was never anticipated that it would take less than a month to form a government.
Yeah, and for those like me who don't remember, that it usually takes at least that, right? Like in every
2 months it takes, and sometimes they needed the additional 30-day extension. I think it is a 38-day extension, that they get initial 38 days, and then they get a 30-day extension when they couldn't form a government. So it's not unusual for it to take 2 months.
And back to Syria for a second, because so many people wonder, there's no way to determine if Israel's better, you know, present Assad or post Assad, right? There's no way.
It's exactly right. You can't tell. There's nobody on the horizon right now who looks much better.
Because as you read the papers each day, you're like anticipating his fall, and then I say to myself, wait a second, maybe I shouldn't anticipate his fall.
Well, one is to favor and one is to expect, and I think you're right that nobody can tell right now to get a Muslim Brotherhood or Islamist regime there. Iran has, by the way, invested with some of the opposition as well. So to wish for that may be something we will be very unhappy about later. You see already the moves along Israel's border, which is why they built the fence and why they enhanced their security position there. And the concern is from both sides about whether Syria uses it to excite the populace and try to unite them, or the rebels do things to try to stimulate an Israeli response. What is clear is that there is no leader on the horizon, and the inability of the West to create an alternative leadership, and the idea that this National Security Syrian Front or any of the parties that are fighting, which are completely separated in most cases, I think is something that has to be weighed very carefully. You have to think about
right.
who and how the transition will take place, how the transition will take place, who would be in a position to lead. Would they leave Assad in place? Will Assad stay in Syria? Will there be a division? Will you see the country break up? There are many prospects.
All right, there are a couple of issues that our listeners have been very anxious for you to address this week, so let me just get to these. We always talk about whether, concentrating on local issues, but this one is local and global. Students for Justice in Palestine, the whole Brooklyn College situation. What would you recommend at this point regarding this early February event?
Look, I think the freedom of speech is recognized, but the fact that the political science department would lend its name, which in fact puts the imprimatur of Brooklyn College there, is absolutely unacceptable. This is a boycott movement. This is racist. This is hostile. They wouldn't allow it in regard to any other situation. This is not a question of academic freedom. If some student group wants to do something, it's one thing. And we have right, and students there especially would have a right and an obligation to speak out against it and to stop it and get people to understand that this is in fact not contributing to peace, a BDS movement. It's not justified. It in fact undermines peace. It undermines Palestinians, the tens of thousands who work in the settlements alone, the rest of whose economy depends upon these relationships. The BDS movement is a cloak for anti-Israel and anti-Jewish groups who need a legitimization, and they use this issue. So I think Brooklyn College has to be held to account. I think the president of Brooklyn's letter does not answer the situation and should be taken to task.
So if a government official does not condemn it, you'd say that's unacceptable at this point?
I think it is inappropriate for the university, for a college, any college, to give its support, either financial or otherwise, to such a hateful session.
Right, but I'm just saying that a lot of people are using this as a litmus test to see how government officials, local and otherwise, are reacting to it, and you're saying that that's legitimate.
Absolutely.
They should be outspoken on this. And also, listeners wanted to hear you react. The London Sunday Times, this cartoon depicting Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu building a blood-stained wall using what appeared to be the bodies of Palestinians. Did the paper deserve the reaction they got or not?
Absolutely. And first, it was on Yom HaShoah, on Holocaust
right.
Memorial Day.
Well, not Yom HaShoah, but Holocaust Remembrance Day, right?
Holocaust Remembrance right. Day, right. The international...
Right. The UN.
Recognized by the UN.
Right.
So that augmented the insult and the injury. It was outrageous. Murdoch, who owns the paper, apologized. But we'll have to see what other actions are taken there. But it was truly an outrageous depiction. It's one thing to mock or to satirize, or even to criticize. But there have to be some limits.
We spoke to Senator Schumer, as you know, 2 weeks ago today, and you followed that conversation on the air. That was regarding the Hagel nomination. Now that process has begun, and the news sources, certainly the New York Times, are reporting how difficult the session went yesterday on the Hill for Hagel. Do you think that Senator Schumer or others who've endorsed the nomination might come to regret it?
I certainly think that he performed very poorly, that a number of senators who were leaning towards approval have now indicated that they are reconsidering. The exchanges were remarkable in a number of ways, but one was that the appearance that he wasn't prepared,
right.
that he refused to answer. Even when asked three times the same to clarify his position, I would say that if some of the senators who have come out for him would today reverse their position or make clear their position, I think his nomination could be in jeopardy.
Oh, so maybe that's what I should be calling for publicly on the air now, that they should reverse what they originally said.
Well, reverse or at least reconsider. You know, there
right.
are maybe people who. He has given explanations for what he said, but
right.
the question is, what is the sincerity? And it's not just the Jewish or Israel issues, it's Iran, it's many other
right.
issues. And in this case, it had to do with the surge, I think with Senator McCain,
mm-hmm.
and other issues that senators raised. That, as the Secretary of Defense, I mean, these are all relevant issues.
Hey, Senator Schumer, reverse the mistake you made on Hagel, please. Also, why did Stanley Fischer resign as governor of the Israel Central Bank?
Well, he's been there for a long time. I think he looked at other options. I met with him about a month ago. I didn't seem like somebody who was unhappy in a position. I think he decided it was time.
In Iran, this blast at a nuclear site that we heard about this week. So first of all, how significant a site was it, and has Israel said anything about this blast?
It's an extremely important site at Fordo. It is a major enrichment site. The question is it true? And
oh, it may not have been hit, you're saying?
Well, was it a hit? If it took place, was it a hit? Was it some sort of internal explosion? When events like that occur, Israel and other security forces generally do not comment on them.
Right.
Because you don't want to give the enemy an excuse to say that it was that party and retaliate, or B, that they know, and whoever did it knows, and that those are the only ones who have to know. But there are questions about it. The IAEA yesterday said that it did not take place. There is no indication of evacuation of people. I heard last night a report that they, in fact, have re-entered the location, that there was a collapse, that many people were trapped inside, that certain countries were angry because their scientists were working there, and that they entered from a place many kilometers away, and that there seems to be these emergency exits and entrances into this facility. So, A, you get a sense of how big it is, and B, that it's possible something very serious took place, but we do not know yet.
And the number of sites that are related in some way to the Iranian nuclear weapons program are too many to count, or not?
Too many to count, but it is proliferated. We don't necessarily know all the locations. They may have secret facilities, as we've uncovered in a place like Fordo, which is built inside a mountain and under 30 feet of concrete, and many people believe impenetrable even to bombing. Now you see that there are certain bombs that work, and it may have set off secondary and tertiary explosions. So there are many facilities we don't know about. The research facilities, as you saw, the space program is really integrally part of it, as I'm sure many other research programs. There are medical isotopes that they claim are being developed in one reactor. Who knows? It's just all... You know, it's fungible in terms of the experience and in terms of the relationship to the central program was evident when they took the rods out of the facility in Bushehr, which was supposed to be absolutely protected and impenetrable, etc. So the Iranians showed that all of these facilities can be compromised.
Right, which I guess is good news. And even with Syria, the one that always gets me and is most difficult for me to understand is what's going on in Egypt. We see the riots happening and the do we call this an unstable government or not, or just the opposite? It's so stable or so entrenched that essentially he could do whatever he wants, Morsi.
Well, he is the government, and he is moving to consolidate power all the time. And we see the more restrictions being imposed on the media and other outlets. I think that they were taken aback by the demonstrations in Port Said and other places, where the demonstrations were really for independence, not just against a particular action and the trial, the outcome of the trial. The spread of these demonstrations to Tahrir Square, the crackdown by police and army. The army has been essentially bought off, but at some point... And may decide that they have to play a more assertive role. And the question is, do they do it again, willing to take a stand against the government, or do they do it in concert with the government? And the forces of opposition have proven themselves, while they can be vocal, to be pretty weak, that they're not unified and not organized in a way that they can really pose a challenge. And Morsi's big challenge is the economy. And as these things continue to go on, it not only distracts him and the country's resources, but it also means that tourism and investments are much more likely when you have such an unstable situation.
Unbelievable. And, of course, we all wonder what this means for Israel's security on that front, and we just don't know in the long run, right?
Well, we're seeing a couple of trends. One is that he'll publicly sustain the agreement with Israel. He's really putting a lot of the cooperation in deep freeze, and will, as some of his aides have said, that he will move away from any kind of normalization. You saw the statements he made and that some of his aides have made, denying the Holocaust, really blatantly anti-Semitic statements. Chancellor Merkel really took him to task when he visited Germany 2 days ago, when he was in Berlin for his anti-Jewish comments. The United States did as well, and indicated that his explanations, responses were inadequate for what he did. But I think, you know, people shouldn't be surprised. This is what he is, and this is what he believes. And we can try to whitewash it and say, well, he said it was out of context. There was no out of context. We heard what he said. It was broadcast. It was clear. And that, you know, he's the fact that he had a series of aides, including the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, has made really hostile and horrific statements that cross the line from anti-Israel into anti-Semitic, even though in their case there is no line.
Right. We always forget that, but that's one and the same, right?
Right.
Simple as that. Finally, Malcolm, your comment to one of the most interesting stories regarding the Israeli election, whether you say it's 38 or 39 or 40, and we had all three said on these airways by different guests over the last 10 days, there is almost, or there is, one-third of the Knesset who identifies as what we would call traditional Jews at this point. What do you think, 65 years later, that a third of the Knesset is what we would call Orthodox?
Well, I think that it could even be more than a third. I've heard up to 43. So,
wow.
But I guess it depends on your definition.
Right, exactly.
Who you include, but I don't like the idea of defining it that way, but it is an interesting statistic, and you know, and they come from very different parties. I mean, it's really surprising in some cases. So, you know, it's not a unified ideological bloc or political bloc, because they often differ between themselves as much as any of the parties do, or the secular or more secular elements would. The but it is an interesting statement.
Yeah, but by the way, I just brought it up as like an interesting piece of trivia, like that we've gotten.
But it's
to...
not trivia. I think it is an important statement at a time when everybody plays down, and these are not, you know, the Haredi elements. Alone, this is for a long time, you know, the religious Zionist movement was confined to Mizrahi or a smattering of others. Now, today, you have it spread across the spectrum, which many people said was the ideal that they had sought for a long time.
Right, amazing. All right, Malcolm, we'll speak again next week. Have a wonderful Shabbos, and thank you for joining us.
Pleasure, good job.
Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. We call it the Weekly Update, 7:40 in the morning on Friday here at JM.